of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, August 27th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Santa Barbara supervisors vote in favor of offshore drilling. A new book calls attention to John McCain's racism. And Russia recognizes two breakaway Georgian provinces, provoking greater fears of a new Cold War.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Russia announced yesterday that it would recognize the independence of two breakaway Georgian provinces over which it fought a minor war earlier this month. President Bush denounced what he called an irresponsible decision on Russia's part. NATO's decision-making body, the North Atlantic Council, also condemned the move and urged Russia to reverse its position. But Russian President Dmitry Medvedev defended the move, saying that Georgia forced Russia's hand by trying to gain control by force in the smaller of the two provinces, South Ossetia. He also said, quote, "We are not afraid of anything, including the prospect of a Cold War." The U.S. intends to use a Navy destroyer and Coast Guard cutter to deliver what it's calling a humanitarian shipment to the region this week. Georgia is a staunch ally of the U.S. in the Caucasus region, a major transit corridor for energy supplies to Europe, and a strategic crossroads close to the Middle East, Iran, and Afghanistan, and energy-rich Central Asia. Meanwhile, Vice President Dick Cheney is due to visit Georgia next week. My guest is David Kotz. He's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's a co-author of a book called Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, The Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia. Welcome to Uprising, Professor Kotz.
I'm glad to be with you, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about what you think Russian President Dmitry Medvedev really means when he says he's not afraid of a Cold War. He's not afraid of the prospect of a Cold War?
Well, I think he's again stating that Russia, the Russian government, intends to pursue what it sees as its own interests in this area without being very concerned about the reaction from the United States or NATO.
Are you surprised by this move following the war?
Well, it was not clear that Russia was going to do this so quickly. Many thought this would be a matter for negotiation, and until this announcement, Russia had recognized Georgian sovereignty over South Ossetia and Abkhazia, but had also called for the for autonomy of those two regions. I think this is a result. This action is a direct result of the United States and its close allies' actions in the Serbia-Kosovo case, where which was it's almost exactly parallel.
Explain that.
Well, Serbia, a longstanding close ally of Russia, had a breakaway province in Kosovo. And the United States was the main force in sending troops in, NATO troops, to expel the Serbian authorities from the Kosovo province. And Kosovo had been internationally recognized as part of Serbia. And then this past spring, Kosovo, with U.S. encouragement, declared independence. And at that time, the Russian government said this will have implications for South Ossetia and Abkhazia. But Russia didn't do anything until Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, used military force to try to reassert the Georgian government control over South Ossetia.
Now, what does Russia's recognition of the independence mean in terms of international law, and what role does the UN play here?
Well, that's a good question. The UN has not officially recognized Kosovo as an independent nation. It's a conflict of two principles, the territorial integrity of existing nation states with their national boundaries and the right of peoples to self-determination. These have always been potentially conflicting principles. And by and large, the big powers in recent times have supported the integrity of nation states over the right of minorities to self-determination.
Well, speaking of self-determination, what is your sense of what the people of these two regions want? The AP is reporting that, quote, many South Ossetians have expressed a desire for integration into Russia.
Well, I think that's pretty clear. The South Ossetia is part of Ossetia, which is an ethnically defined region that straddled the Russia-Georgia border during Soviet times. And it seems clear from everything one can find out that the ethnic Ossetians in South Ossetia, which is the big majority, don't really want independence. They want to join the North Ossetians as part of Russia.
David, is it overreaction when to hear some folks say, "Well, this is just basically Russia expanding its territory." If you know now, once it starts with South Ossetia and Abkhazia, that you don't know which is next. I mean, is this going to be the beginning of major expansion? What do you think about that?
Well, of course, it's hard to predict, but I think it is important to note the distortion in the major media, in the way that they have portrayed this, what has happened so far. Normally, expansionism involves ultimately taking over regions where the people do not want to be part of the expanding state. That's not what has happened here. The major media have portrayed this as a brutal Russian invasion following squabbling over the status of the territory. But that's misleading. What happened was there was a status quo that was peaceful, relatively peaceful, had been accepted by all sides, at least for the time being, and then it was Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili's attack that a few days later, led to Russia's intervention. So I'm not endorsing Russia's intervention, but I'm saying the reality is more complex than the way the media has presented it, and it's too soon to say what Russia will do in other situations where there are peoples who perhaps look favorably on Russia and would like to get independence from their current state membership. We'll have to see.
My guest is David Kotz, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's the co-author of Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, The Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia. Well, David, just following from what you just said, are we looking at a future in the Central Asian region where a lot of these former Soviet nations that are now independent could start breaking up into smaller and smaller pieces and maybe preparing for an eventual reintegration into Russia and maybe, a reincarnation or a different reincarnation of what used to be the Soviet Union?
Well, most of the former Soviet republics do not have breakaway regions. Some do. There is, I guess, the most publicized one is the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, where there's an enclave within Azerbaijan that is of Armenian ethnicity. The people are Armenian. And there is also an issue in Moldova. But I don't think that's going to, in itself, lead to a reassembly of the former Soviet Union. I think the way to view this in a larger context has to do with the U.S. government drive to dominate as much of the former Soviet Union and its neighborhood as possible. As soon as the Soviet Union broke up, the U.S. government, contrary to promises that had been made to Mikhail Gorbachev, move to assert dominance, first in Eastern Europe and then in the former Soviet republics in Central Asia, in the Caucasus. Particularly the ones that had valuable raw materials or the ones that had strategic location. And they just pushed and pushed and pushed. And the Russian leadership initially wanted, didn't really care much about the region and just wanted to have good relations with the U.S. That was Boris Yeltsin's policy. Eventually, this was bound to produce a reaction. So I think it should be understood as the most powerful capitalist country in the world, the U.S., trying to dominate as much of the world as possible versus what is now a smaller but still potentially powerful capitalist, now capitalist country, Russia, which is starting to push to protect what it sees as its much more limited sphere of influence.
Well, that's an analysis you certainly don't see in the mainstream media. David, let's we shouldn't also forget the fact that the U.S. now has military bases in Afghanistan, which also is part of the military domination and presence that the U.S. is seeking in this region. Let's talk about NATO. NATO has, of course, condemned, as I mentioned, Russia's move. But where do you see? I mean, you're just looking at the history of course. Why NATO was formed initially in terms of a reaction to the Soviet Union. Today, where do you see NATO or how do you see NATO reacting to Russia? And is it essentially an arm of U.S. policy?
Well, it used to be, but on certain issues, the U.S. can't really get NATO to do what it wants because the West European countries are hesitant to really seriously confront Russia over this because they're not willing to go to war over Georgia, I think, is what it comes to. It's not even clear the U.S. would, in the end, be willing to go to war over Georgia. NATO has changed. Originally, NATO was a part of the East-West conflict, which was not really geographic. It was two different social systems that were confronting each other, and NATO represented the dominant capitalist powers, and the Soviet Union and its associated nations had their alliance, and the two confronted each other. The Russian leadership naively assumed that after the Soviet Union was disbanded and state socialism ended in Eastern Europe, that they thought NATO would have no rationale. But the U.S. has tried to use it as an instrument of U.S. imperialist interests in that region. That's not as easy to do, and I'm afraid we've got something that looks a lot more like the pre-World War I kind of division, where various powerful capitalist countries are jockeying for domination in contested areas.
Now, where do you see Russia's position in the coming months in bodies like the G8? I understand Russia's also looking for membership in the World Trade Organization. Will it be sacrificing these positions with this move?
Well, I could never understand why anyone thought not joining the WTO was a sacrifice. I mean, for small countries, there's a stronger reason to join. For
right.
big countries, you know, when China joined in 2001, it put severe pressures on China's macroeconomic growth model because the WTO bans many practices which are helpful for economic development, such as regulating trade and capital movements. Putin said that Russia doesn't care whether they join the WTO. I'm sure there are certain interests in Russia that would like to join WTO because it would give certain Russian capitalist interests better access to markets in certain other countries. But large countries can function outside the WTO.
So it's not as big a deal for Russia, you think, in general?
Well, and also it's the time. I think the institutions that were created in the period of neoliberal or free market dominance that began at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, the World Bank and the IMF changed significantly in their role in the world. The WTO was born. These were institutions that were set up to enforce free market ideas, policies, and institutions. And that whole structure is greatly weakening.
Right.
So it's not clear how strong the WTO is going to be and what's going to happen to it in the coming period.
Finally, David, speaking of China, is Russia looking to China and other Asian allies for support in this time when it is being attacked by the United States for its move to recognize the independence of South Ossetia?
Well, U.S. policy has pushed Russia and China closer together. I mean, in the Cold War, U.S. policy was always trying to divide them. Now it seems to be directed at trying to drive them together. China faces separatists, and the United States government has been cautious, but the United States provides military protection to Taiwan. It's criticizing China over Tibet. Russia has much more sympathetic positions toward China in those cases. So Russia and China do feel that they have in common a U.S. tendency to take positions that threaten what they see as their key interests. So that it is pushing them closer together.
David Kotz, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
David Kotz is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the co-author of Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, the Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia. We've been discussing Russia's recent recognition, just yesterday, in fact, of two breakaway Georgian provinces, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. You are listening to Uprising, and later in the hour, we're going to be hearing about offshore oil drilling in Santa Barbara. We'll also have this week's Who Said That contest, and after today's Subversive Historian, we'll speak with the author of a new book about John McCain's racism. Irwin Tang will join us by phone. Stay tuned.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your Subversive Historian. 87 years ago, on this day in people's history, the British installed Hashemite Fazil bin al-Hussein as the king of Iraq. On August 27, 1921, the son of the leader of the Arab revolts against the Ottoman Empire became known as King Faisal I. By 1920, the British occupation of Iraq was facing a popular revolt as a strong insurgency broke out in the Fallujah area. Trying to reestablish control, the British decided to create the farce of Arab monarchical rule through a plebiscite. But the opponent of King Faisal I was invited to tea by the British and then exiled soon thereafter. The British boasted that Arab rule arrived in Iraq with King Faisal I winning 96% of the rigged plebiscite vote. He would rule until his death, and his son continued the British-friendly monarchy until being disposed by a coup that would eventually see the Ba'ath Party and Saddam Hussein come to power. And we all know what happens after that, if only we could ever learn. For Uprising, this is your truth, Professor, saying it's no mystery why they conceal our history.
And now we come to the special feature of our program.
Who said that? Who said that?
Who is it?
So what do you call yourself, huh? Como se llama?
I can't hear you.
Run.
What's your name, dude?
Who the hell are you?
I really want to know.
If it's anybody, it's me.
Who?
Who?
Before we go to our next story, it's time for this week's edition of Who Said That? A weekly contest in collaboration with the Pacifica Radio Archives. Each week, we'll play you a short soundbite from the archives' vault and ask you to tell us who said that. All you have to do is call in and identify the voice, and we'll send you the CD from the Pacifica Radio Archives that featured the clip you just heard. So let's take a listen to this week's mystery speaker.
Now, the question I raise: is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where people are being murdered, lynched, and killed because we want to register and vote?
And if you know who that is, and if you haven't won yet, call us right now at 818-985-5735 with your best guess. That's 818-985-KPFK. It's an easy one this week, but if you need a hint, I'll give you one. This outspoken activist we just heard crashed the party at the 1964 DNC. Well, you are listening to Uprising, and we are now going to go to our second story. New York Senator Hillary Clinton addressed the Democratic National Convention in Denver yesterday, earning widespread praise for her words of unity and conviction. While her main goal was seen as healing the rift between herself and Barack Obama, she also took a moment to critique Republican presumptive nominee John McCain.
We don't need four more years of the last 8 years. More economic stagnation and less affordable health care. More high gas prices and less alternative energy. More jobs getting shipped overseas and fewer jobs created here at home. More skyrocketing debt and home foreclosures and mounting bills that are crushing middle-class families. More war and less diplomacy. More of a government where the privileged few come first and everyone else comes last. Well, John McCain says the economy is fundamentally sound. John McCain doesn't think 47 million people without health insurance is a crisis. John McCain wants to privatize Social Security, and in 2008, he still thinks it's okay when women don't earn equal pay for equal work. Now, with an agenda like that, it makes perfect sense that George Bush and John McCain will be together next week in the Twin Cities, because these days they're awfully hard to tell apart.
Hillary Clinton addressing the Democratic National Convention yesterday, what she left out of her critique of McCain, and what virtually everyone has left out this year, is McCain's racist background. When John McCain campaigned for president in 2000, he told reporters on his bus, quote, "I hated the gooks. I will hate them as long as I live." McCain used the racist pejorative in describing the Vietnamese people who were targets of a brutal U.S. war that he is proud to have fought in. He apologized for using the term, explaining that he was only using it to refer specifically to the prison guards in Vietnam who beat and tortured him. Now, author Irwin Tang has written a book about McCain called Gook, John McCain's Racism and Why It Matters. In describing the book's thesis, Tang asks, war fertilizes racism and racism justifies wars and the killing of civilians. This dynamic thrives within the most dangerous leaders of the world. Is John McCain one of them? Irwin Tang joins us on the phone this morning. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So, as I mentioned, this is not something that comes up very often at all about John McCain. You would think the Democrats would pick up on it, but they don't. Remind us of a little bit of the backdrop of what happened in 2008. I quoted him and what he said about his experience in the Vietnam War. How did he justify his racist statement?
Well, he distorted the truth. He said that he was only referring to the prison guards who kept him captive. And in reality, he referred to Vietnamese in general as gooks. And so, in essence, he lied. Now, we have very few precise quotes concerning John McCain's use of the word gook. Over 27 years, we rely on some of his own writings where he refers to the Vietnamese as gooks. But during the campaign, we mostly have to rely on a few exact quotes and the general understanding, the reporting of European reporters who had the guts to, write that, hey, John McCain is still using the word gook to refer to Vietnamese people in general. No one said he was using the word only to refer to the Vietnamese prison guards until John McCain himself said, I only talked about the prison guards, and he also stated that he would only stop using the word gook to describe the Vietnamese because, quote, he didn't want to feel the heat.
His campaign. Mm-hmm.
Right. He didn't want to, jeopardize his presidential campaign. And so we see the real heart of John McCain. He's a racist, deeply racist at worst, and hateful at best.
So I understand that his spokespeople, his campaign, tried to, in a way, apologize for him by saying that, you know, and this is a story that comes up over and over again, where we never forget, whenever we hear about John McCain, we always hear about how he was tortured in a POW camp in Vietnam. And was that sort of used as a justification for, you know, that the fact that he was tortured in a way justifies his use of the term?
Of course, that was a justification. It's a justification of many things, apparently, and that is more importantly, that's a justification in people's minds. But there are some veterans out there who have the guts to come out and say, look, you know, there are a lot of us. There are a lot of veterans who have suffered a great deal through the Vietnam War or through the Iraq War or other wars, and we don't use the word gook. We are not racist. We are totally against that type of language. We're not against the Vietnamese people. We're not against an entire race of people. And they have the guts to say, this really concerns us about John McCain. There's something wrong with him.
Now, how do you feel about the fact that this is not making much of a blip? It didn't make much of a blip in the media in 2000, and it's certainly not being raised now.
Well, to tell you the truth, I think one of the problems is the Democratic Party. They're not making this an issue. It's a softball, you know, thrown straight over the plate. It's an easy issue to bring up. Secondly, the media, the American media, has traditionally thought that issues of Asian American identity or pride or dignity are not issues. So if John McCain had said, you know, I hate the N words, we would not be considering him as a presidential candidate.
In fact, compare him to what happened in 2006 to Republican Senator George Allen.
Oh, well. Yeah, exactly. George Allen used a pejorative that refers to people of African descent, the word macaca, and he was a presidential hopeful for the Republican Party at that time, but immediately, and that word was, interestingly, he used it against a person of South Asian descent, actually, but it is a pejorative used against blacks, and he immediately ended his political career. He was no longer presidential hopeful, and he's no longer a member of the Senate.
Now, if the use of the word gook is the only instance of John McCain's racism, you know, the case might not be as big, and you might not have a whole book about it. But you have a broader case than the use of that term in the few instances. What else can you point to build the case? You know, you say he's a racist. Why specifically, or why more broadly, I should say?
Well, he supports three different types of white supremacist organizations in the United States, including the traditional white supremacist / KKK organizations, the Neo-Confederacy movement, and the racist religious anti-Semitic right. The most interesting part to me right now is his monetary support for the Neo-Confederacy movement. He's given hundreds of thousands of dollars to a man named Richard Quinn for his political advice, and Richard Quinn is one of the top leaders of the Neo-Confederacy movement, former editor, longtime editor of the Southern Partisan, and now one of the owners of the Southern Partisan, a journal that justifies slavery, justifies the violence of the KKK, sees Nelson Mandela as a bad egg, Martin Luther King as a and Gandhi as fomenters of violence and so on and so forth, that's disturbing in and of itself. And then you add on top of that his political support and his endorsement of people like George Wallace Jr., who was a popular lecturer among the white supremacy organizations, and I speak specifically of the Council of Conservative Citizens, which sprung out of the white councils, white citizens councils of the South, which were, you know, which which have been largely considered the uptown KKKs. And John McCain, in 2006, this is just 2 years ago, endorsed George Wallace Jr. And went on a speaking tour for George Wallace Jr. throughout Alabama, three cities in Alabama. It's not a big state. And raised tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars for George Wallace Jr. Now, you consider this. If you add up those hundreds or millions of dollars with the hundreds of thousands of dollars or possibly millions of dollars raised for Richard Quinn, and you see that John McCain is a pillar, a foundation, monetary foundation for the white supremacist movement in America, and then you put on top of that his endorsement and support for an endorsement by John Hagee and Rod Parsley, two of the leaders of the racist religious right, who have been outspoken in their racist comments concerning Muslims, their very peculiar and dangerous anti-Semitic statements, and their statements against gays and women. And you come up with a portrait of John McCain that's extremely disturbing. He's behind the scenes in three different branches of extremist racism in America.
My guest is Erwin Tang. His book is Gook, John McCain's Racism and Why It Matters. He's also written Asian Texans and When Invisible Children Sing. He joins us on the phone to talk about what's not being talked about in the mainstream media regarding John McCain. Now, let's talk about the issue of immigration. Recently, reggaeton artist Daddy Yankee endorsed John McCain for what he says is John McCain's supportive stance towards immigrants. But you have an interesting take on that. What is John McCain's real position on immigrants to this country, and how does it also, in your mind, build the case that he's a racist?
Well, I look at his English-only policy, and one of his heroes is Teddy Roosevelt. He even said that recently. Used the word hero to describe Teddy Roosevelt. And of course, Roosevelt was one of our most racist anti-immigrant presidents. And John McCain had his chance to support immigrants of all stripes, of all nationalities in this country when the English-only Inhofe Amendment was up for a vote in the Senate. And he voted for the English-only amendment, which essentially encourages federal agencies to stop providing services in languages other than English, because it states specifically that no one has a right to services in any language except for English. It doesn't necessarily say, you know, we need to get rid of these languages in our federal offices, but it gives a lot of federal offices in the South and such, where these things are more likely to happen, gives them the freedom and the support to say, just stop hiring interpreters and translators and such.
Erwin, I want to end this interview with a broad question. Of course, race, just by virtue of Barack Obama being a major party presidential candidate, is naturally going to be a big part of this presidential race, whether it's overtly mentioned or not. John McCain's attitudes are, as I mentioned and we've talked about, really not being raised by the media. What do you see happening in the between now and early November in terms of these issues being raised, and also, do you foresee John McCain, using racist ads or using coded language and the kind of thing that we've already seen a little bit from his campaign? Do you see that worsening between now and November?
Absolutely, I see it worsening. John McCain has admitted that he has a deep ambition to be president. And Terry Nelson was one of the architects of one of the most racist ads in recent political history. It was the ad against Harold Ford, which involved filming a blonde white actress saying that she had met the senatorial candidate at a Playboy mansion party, and saying, "Call me Harold." And it was obviously a race baiting ad that Terry Nelson put together. And Sarah Nelson was actually fired by Walmart for doing this racist ad, but he was immediately hired by John McCain after that to be John McCain's national campaign organizer, national campaign manager. And so we see that John McCain is very, very much willing to hire the people necessary to create the race-baiting ads, the racist ads, to make him president. And so it was not surprising to see Paris Hilton and Britney Spears on yet another Republican campaign ad, because John McCain is very conscious of this and very much willing to do what it takes. Now, what concerns me now is when we talk about John McCain and Barack Obama, they might be very, very directly linked at some point in a very sad way, because John McCain, through his monetary support, his political support, and his words, has supported the white supremacy movement in the United States. And that, to me, is directly linked to the possibility that there were three white supremacists arrested recently in Denver who may have been trying to assassinate Barack Obama.
I mean, are you saying that he sort of encourages this kind of thing?
I'm saying that through his money, his words, he doesn't, I mean, obviously John McCain has not said, I think, you know, someone should go shoot Barack Obama, but by his endorsements of white supremacists, his endorsing words, his praise of people like George Wallace Jr. and his praise of people like Richard Quinn and John Hagee and Rod Parsley, he's basically saying this is, and he's an American hero. When you hear an American hero saying, praising white supremacists and the supremacist movements that also endorse the arming of white Americans against the dangers of immigration and the dangers of quote unquote black thugs. These are the type of people that George Wallace Jr. supports, and through that John McCain supports.
So you're saying he, in a way, condones that sort of behavior.
It encourages it indirectly,
right.
I believe. Encourages his John McCain's support of white supremacy encourages white Americans to arm themselves and commit crimes.
Hmm. Irwin, where can listeners find out more about your book?
You can go to irwinbooks.com. It's IRWINBOOKS.com.
And you can order a copy directly through there.
Yes, they can. People can buy the book directly there or go to Amazon.com.
Well, Irwin Tang, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
All right, thank you very much.
Irwin Tang is author of Gook, John McCain's Racism and Why It Matters. His earlier books, Asian Texans and When Invisible Children Sing. You can find out more about these books, in particular the one we've just been discussing, at irwinbooks.com. That's spelled IRWINbooks.com. You are listening to Uprising, and before we go to break, the winner of this week's Who Said That is Ken Farr. Congratulations for guessing the correct answer, Ken, and which is, of course, Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer was instrumental in organizing the Mississippi Freedom Summer for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She later became the vice chair of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, attending the 1964 Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey. She ran for Congress in 1964 and 65 and was then seated as a member of Mississippi's legitimate delegation to the DNC of 1968, where she was an outspoken critic of the Vietnam War. Her tombstone reads, "I am sick and tired of being sick and tired." We'll send a copy of the CD, Collected Speeches of Fannie Lou Hamer, to our winner, Ken Farr. Let's take another listen to the clip we just played.
Now, the question I raise, is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where people are being murdered, lynched, and killed because we want to register and vote?
And that is Fannie Lou Hamer. And for those of you who didn't win, you can order this excellent CD featuring this clip. It's called Collected Speeches of Fannie Lou Hamer from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And, of course, Who Said That is a contest that we have every Wednesday. So if you want another chance to win, come back Wednesday and try. But, of course, don't stop listening. We'll be right back after this short break to find out why Santa Barbara's county supervisors have voted for offshore oil drilling in the region. Stay tuned.
This is KPFK senior producer Alan Minsky. here to let you know about some of KPFK's upcoming afternoon coverage of the Democratic National Convention. At 2 p.m. today, I'll be speaking with Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, who is at the convention in Denver. And then I'll be joined by African-American Studies professor Gerald Horn, who will offer his reflections on the eve of Barack Obama's historic nomination. Also, feminist media critic Professor Susan J. Douglas will comment on Hillary Clinton's speech and how she feels gender issues are playing out in the 2008 election cycle. All that at 2 p.m. today. At 4 p.m., host John Wiener will be speaking with authors Andrew Bacevich and Rick Perlstein about the DNC and the prospects for progressive change in American politics. And then, tomorrow at 4 p.m., Ian Masters will be hosting a special hour leading into coverage of Barack Obama's acceptance speech. All that on KPFK in the afternoons.
Welcome back to Uprising. Before we go to our final story, I want to announce the winners of KPFK's iPhone sweepstakes from last week's summer sign-up membership drive. You recall that we were signing up members, and you could win an iPhone 1 every single day. For Friday, August 15th, Betsy Trowell of Laguna Hills won an iPhone. For the Saturday, August 16th drawing, Kelly Chambers of LA won an iPhone. For the Sunday, August 17th drawing, Frank Boeheim of Los Angeles won an iPhone. And for the Monday, August 18th drawing, Anwar of Newport Beach was a winner. For the Tuesday, August 19th drawing, Reynold Chavez in L.A. won the phone. And for the Wednesday, August 20th drawing, Bland Crowder from Richmond, Virginia won an iPhone. For the Thursday, August 21st drawing, Serge LeBlanc from Westlake Village won. And finally, last Friday, August 22nd, David H. of Santa Monica won the iPhone. Tune in tomorrow to hear the winners of the other sweepstakes prizes, including the signed guitars and event tickets. Thanks to everybody, by the way, who contributed, and congratulations to our winners. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told Meet the Press on Sunday that she would consider offshore oil drilling as part of a comprehensive energy plan for the United States. The California Congresswoman conditioned her statements by reiterating that drilling is not a good option, but if used to invest in renewable energy resources, it might be worthwhile. Pelosi's statements are just the latest in the national debate over offshore oil drilling's role in defining our energy future. Locally, the issue is playing out in Santa Barbara when its county board of supervisors voted 3-2 yesterday to send a letter to Governor Schwarzenegger in favor of oil exploration and extraction in the region. The vote came after a public comment hearing in Santa Maria where both sides of the debate addressed their positions. Proponents of drilling off the shores of Santa Barbara stated that doing so would create employment, revenue, and increase oil supplies nationally. Opposing environmentalists contend that the costs are not being weighed against the benefits and that lifting an existing moratorium on drilling is really a Trojan horse for oil corporations to gain new leases. My guest is David Landecker. He is the executive director of the Environmental Defense Center. Welcome to Uprising, David.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So first, let's talk about the broader national context and the way in which the Democrats are turning on the issue of offshore oil drilling, something that I don't think too many people expected, particularly environmentalists. What do you make of Pelosi saying that drilling is okay if we use the benefits from drilling to invest in renewable energy resources?
Well, I think we first have to notice the fact that the whole issue is polling very well. There's a lot of concern about gas prices. There's a lot of concern about foreign imports. There's just a lot of concern about where people are going to get the energy that they need. And as long as the federal government puts out this idea, or the state government, anyone puts out this idea that we can magically solve this problem by drilling offshore of either California or Florida or Louisiana, people are going to say, well, let's go do it. And that's sort of what's happening. And so when the polling indicates that, both parties seem to be going in that direction.
Well, but polling may be a result of people feeling that the gas pump is going to get a lot less expensive if we drill offshore. Is that at all accurate?
No. All indications are that that's not accurate at all.
Basically, it'll just pad the pockets of the oil corporations even more.
Well, first of all, if we were to issue these leases almost immediately, if we were to say, yes, we're going to lift the moratorium, there's a whole process, and there won't be any new oil coming out of the Outer Continental Shelf for 10, 15, maybe even 20 years. So there's not any immediate effect. Interestingly, the letter that was put out by the Board of Supervisors indicated that somehow, because the board said that Santa Barbara County was no longer opposed to oil, oil prices would suddenly go down as the international market cowered at this. Number one, international. I mean, the possibility of a hurricane in the Gulf has had a much bigger impact on oil prices than anything the Santa Barbara Board of Supervisors could do. And oil prices don't seem to be reacting these days to supply issues. It's about international speculation. It's about needs all over the world. And what Santa Barbara County or the Outer Continental Shelf could offer to the international oil picture even 20 years from now is really fairly insignificant. However, it's a good thing for the oil companies, and there's a moment of opportunity here. There's a moment of opportunity for political parties, and there's a moment of opportunity for oil companies, and they're jumping on it.
So let's talk about what happened yesterday in Santa Barbara. The County Board of Supervisors voted, as I mentioned, 3-2, to sort of a symbolic vote. They're encouraging Governor Schwarzenegger that that they could welcome exploration and extraction in the region. What was your response to that?
Well, I think we have to begin with the fact that this really isn't anything new. It's a quest for headlines. It's a quest for the sort of discussion that's going on right here. But the fact that there is a split in Santa Barbara County between the North County, which is much more conservative and much more interested in the idea of let's produce some dollars right now, against the South County, which bears the impact of this drilling and dealt with the spill in 1969 and has continually been opposed to oil drilling, has been true for 35, 40 years in our community. And it has been a continual seesaw, 3-2 vote either on the side of the South or the side of the North as to who is going to be controlling our Board of Supervisors. And the oil wars have gone on in this county for all of that period. This is nothing new. The only thing that really happened here is that the board decided they were going to step out and make a statement in this politically charged atmosphere. It has made a lot of news because it is a politically charged atmosphere, but it really isn't a big change.
My guest is David Landecker, Executive Director of the Environmental Defense Center, speaking to us from Santa Barbara. So do you basically feel that that the symbolic vote can be countered, if you will, by effective action from groups like yours if you can convince the county or even, for example, the governor to see reason?
Well, the governor, no more than a month ago, made a very clear statement that he did not favor additional drilling for oil and that he is a supporter of spending our time and money and efforts to seek alternative energy sources. And we're with him on that one. And I think one thing groups like ours can do, or your listeners all over Southern California can do, is just support the governor in that. Our state has been on the cutting edge of saying we are going to try to find alternatives. We're going to try to build a new economy based upon alternative energy.
David, what do you make of the fact that some have suggested that offshore drilling will actually benefit the environment?
Well, that's a whole different, interesting discussion. It goes back a long time as well. There, allegation, and what they're saying is that there are natural seeps, which there have been for hundreds and hundreds of years.
What does that mean?
Seeps of both gas and oil that bubble up from under the ground through the water. Anyone who's walked on the shores of Santa Barbara knows you get tar on your feet, and that tar is from natural seepage of oil. And if you drive a boat out in certain areas off our coast, you can actually smell the hydrogen sulfide gas. It doesn't smell good. It bubbles up. And what they are suggesting is that if they drill for more oil, they will take the pressure off of that. That will reduce this the amount of gas that goes into the atmosphere, which will cut down on ozone and cut down on precursors for global warming.
How convenient. So they'll just take the oil out of the ground for us.
That, you know, the thing is that's, you go back 30 years, and ARCO, when they first built Platform Holly, which was a pretty long time ago, as part of their mitigations, put what was called a seep tent. They put a big underground metal tent into to try to collect some of these gases, and it actually has been relatively successful. It's collected some gases, but there continues to be a lot of this seepage all over this area. There really is no evidence one way or another. There are some theories that say perhaps this would cut down on the amount of gas, but overall the experts seem to be saying right now, well, there may be a small impact, and there may not be a small impact. We really don't know, but no one seems to think that it's going to have an enormous impact on pollution. This is another one of those arguments that gets put out there, and it's sort of allowed a certain amount of cover for the oil companies to suddenly say they're environmentalists, that drilling for oil in the channel is environmentally good. We don't buy it.
David, you mentioned that the issue of offshore oil drilling has support publicly across the nation, but what about in Santa Barbara? How do Santa Barbarans feel about offshore drilling off of their coast in general?
Well, we haven't done any independent polling of what Santa Barbara feels. I think, as I suggested, in the South County, in the city of Santa Barbara and Carpinteria and the areas that are most affected by this oil drilling, there is a general dislike of oil drilling. There's a general fear of what the impacts are going to be, of the possibility of another spill. And there's an attitude, I think, that is somewhat progressive that says, it's time for our country to move on. And as long as we can continue to get this fix of oil and find a place to get it, we're not going to address the getting off of oil. And so people are really supportive of spending our money instead of on oil exploration on alternatives. In the north of the county, the feeling is if we can make some money now, if we can meet some of our deficits by this magical oil money that theoretically will come in, let's go for it. Now, what's most interesting is that there are a whole lot of leases that are out there already that aren't being used and that we're not getting any money out of. So what's to think if we create more leases right now that will suddenly produce more dollars? There isn't a whole lot of logic behind that. Who it will produce dollars for is the balance sheets of oil companies that will suddenly have major additional assets. There's no saying, however, that they're actually going to exploit those.
And oil companies are among the few in an industry that is one of very few that's actually making record profits in this failing economy.
They certainly are. Part of the reason for the failing economy is that oil prices have gotten so high and there's so much profit being made.
Finally, David, very briefly, is there a strategy that environmentalists like yourself have to counter the public opinion and you do some sort of public education about oil drilling, offshore oil drilling, and why, in your mind, it would not be beneficial either to the environment, certainly, or to even people's pocketbooks?
Well, we're continuing to do the sort of thing we're doing here. We continue to talk about it. The fact is that this is not a sea change. It happens. It's a political issue, and it's being it's in the context of the politics of the year 2008 nationally. We will continue, in some ways, bringing this to the surface, having it talked about, we think benefits us. And, as we watch the ads that are on television, as much as we hear people talking about offshore oil and pretending that that's a panacea to our problems, we're also hearing that everybody is talking about the need to pursue alternative sources of energy.
And is there a website for your organization?
There is. It's www.edcnet.org.
edcnet.org. edcnet.org. EDC stands for Environmental Defense Center. I've been speaking with David Landecker, the executive director. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you.
For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I'd like to quote Bill Vaughan, who once said, "Man is the animal that intends to shoot himself out into interplanetary space. After having given up on the problem of an efficient way to get himself 5 miles to work and back each day." That's Bill Vaughan, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, which is linked via kpfk.org. Our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.